The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am pleased to introduce our guests this evening. Nick Stone is an Atlanta native and a Spelman College graduate. Her debut novel for young adults, Dear Martin, and her debut middle grade novel, Clean Getaway, were both New York Times bestsellers. Dear Justice, the sequel to Dear Martin, was recently published. She is also one of the authors in the New York Times bestselling book, Blackout, which was recently optioned for a new anthology program for Netflix by the Obama's production company, Higher Ground. Ibram X. Kendi is the Andrew Mellon Professor in the Humanities at Boston University and the founding director of the BU Center for Anti-Racist Research. He is the author of many books, including Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America, which won the National Book Award for Nonfiction. In 2020, Time Magazine named him one of the 100 most influential people in the world, and he was awarded a 2021 MacArthur Fellowship, popularly known as the Genius Grant. Based on Kendi's internationally acclaimed book and co-authored by Nick Stone, How to Be a Young Anti-Racist is a dynamic reframing of the concepts shared in How to Be an Anti-Racist, with young adulthood front and center. Tonight's authors will be in conversation with our friend Tamala Edwards, Anchor 6 ABC Action News Morning Edition. Please join me in welcoming Nick Stone, Ibram X. Kendi, and Tamala Edwards to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Good evening, good evening. Thank you for coming out this evening. And of course, we are so excited to have the two of you here to talk about this. And I was looking through some of the questions, and one was from a 10-year-old wanting to know what you had learned from each other, but also what made you want to do this book? Because we'll start with you, Ibram, because so many of these ideas have been out there. What made you say, I want to go back, talk to a younger me? And Nick, it's a great concept in the book, almost writing a letter back to him, who he would have been as a teenager. So tell me a little bit about why you wanted to do it and why you chose to do it that way.
You come in with the heat.
Oh, you could do that one in your sleep.
You go first.
Well, very simply, our young adults are facing or experiencing or trying to understand or confronting racism. And they have a tremendous number of questions about what to do, how to be, how to sort of interact. And in many cases, they're not getting answers to those questions. And so just as adults were asking even me, after writing Stamped from the Beginning and even writing about this history of not just racist ideas, but anti-racist ideas, were asking me, okay, how can I be an anti-racist? Like, that was almost a new concept for them. So too are young people, right? Young people want to transform the world too. Young people want to transform themselves too. Young people, again, are facing the ravages of racism too. So for me, it was critically important to provide this tool for those young people.
I mean, like, the short answer is I'd just be trying to be different. Like, truly, when I think about writing a book, I know that there are no new stories to be told, so I have to find creative ways of telling them. And with this particular story, I don't know, there was something about second person that just felt right. Like it was the right way of telling the story, because it gave me two things in one. Number one, it gave me the ability to speak directly to the reader, but it gave me the ability to speak to the reader through the lens of Ibram, right? So, like, I'm talking to Ibram and telling him his own story, but the person who is reading is also reading it as, like, if I say you, you're thinking, like, me, right? So I'd just be trying to be clever.
Ibram, one of the things that I liked, and I think a lot of the young readers in here might like, is one makes a lot of assumptions, and one would assume you were born knowing and understanding all of this and being on the right path. And the crux of the book is we meet you when you're about to give this speech that you cringe when you think about now. And then it's not just that. There's so many steps where you're having to interrogate, rethink, restart, remap how you look at things. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that. Tell them who you were at 17 and how you looked at the world and what that means to be willing to be curious and to change course.
So at 17 years old, which was the year 2010, no, I'm just playing, was 2000, I gave a speech as a senior in high school for an MLK oratorical contest. I thought I was so radical and progressive, when indeed, during my speech, I expressed many of the ideas I had internalized over the course of the 1990s, particularly about Black youth. And so there were all these ideas circulating about Black youth not valuing education. I said that. There were all these ideas in the 1990s devaluing Black teenage girls for having babies. I said that. There were all these ideas claiming that even Black people did not sort of have intestinal fortitude, that we weren't taking personal responsibility. You know, I said that. I said all these things that I thought were wrong with Black people when indeed what I was saying was wrong. Certainly not, you know, Black people. And so in many ways, I thought it was important, both certainly in the adult edition, but even in this young people's edition, so people can understand how I reached that point. All those ideas I had learned and internalized, but more importantly, how I was able to begin to unlearn those racist ideas and begin learning more anti-racist ideas, which are much more difficult to learn and understand, particularly in a racist world, but it is possible.
Nick, you bring so many different things to the book. You talk in a little aside about being in a queer space yourself, an author yourself, other things that you talk about. The book isn't just about racism. It's about so many other isms, about how we look at people in any number of ways and wanting to put them in a box and really rethinking that. And I thought that was something different, that even something like your space, how are you looking at space? How are you looking at colorism? How are you looking at the jokes you tell? That it's not just the work of thinking about race, it's the work of thinking about all of it. Why do I think I have a right or a need to address someone in this way? And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, because I think a lot of people see it as a binary. I just need to think about race, but it's really reorientating yourself towards treating everyone like a human.
Yeah, I mean, look, really what we're talking about here is marginalization, right? There are various ways for a person to be marginalized, and all of these marginalizations interact with each other. When I think about, and Ibram, like, smashed this whole explanation thing in the adult version, which is part of the reason I wanted to adapt it for younger readers, because there were so many things that I learned reading about the interaction or the intersection of race and racism and homophobia, or racism and transphobia, or racism, like the ways that racism interacts with these other forms of marginalization, like this is how inequity is perpetuated, right? So one of my favorite parts of the book is I had an opportunity to take some of the ideas in the adult book and just put some examples on the page. And there's a part where there are these juxtapositions of a person expressing a racist idea towards an individual and a person expressing a racist idea toward a racial group because of an individual, right? So it's like, you know, X type of people can't drive, so you know such and such got in a car accident because they're this type of person. That's one way that racism functions. And the other way is, well, X got into an accident, you know X type of people can't drive, right? So these ideas where you take these two different things, like there's racism, sometimes it intersects with, we were talking about homophobia, such and such people, such and such gay people deal with more HIV and AIDS than this other group of racialized gay people. All of these things really are designed to keep people on the fringes, but for what, right? When you get down to the bottom of all of this, it's just all about dehumanization. The goal is to elevate oneself above everyone else, but the only way to elevate yourself above people who literally are the exact same species as you is to treat those people like they are not the same species as you. So we just have to be very careful about the ideas that we have and how we're moving through the world based on them, which is why I basically took Ibram's book and chopped it into little pieces and put it together in a different way.
And if I can just sort of add really quickly, you know, about, you know, Nick's point about dehumanization, I don't think we fully recognize the ways in which racist ideas prevent us from being fully human. Hmm. And I'm not saying fully human like in a genetic sense or even a behavioral sense, because we're all fully human in both a genetic and behavioral sense. I'm talking about in a social and political sense. What I mean by socially is the way in which you as a human being is able to understand where you sort of fit within the larger world, you can gain a better understanding of yourself by understanding other people. Mm-hmm. The more you understand about other people, the more you understand about yourself. And the more you understand about yourself and other people, the more you can be connected socially to those other people. But if you imagine that they're better or worse than you, it prevents you from finding the fullness of humanity, or really from being able to touch and feel and connect to the fullness of humanity and all of its diversity because of your racist ideas. And from a political standpoint, if you don't understand that what you're facing, the injustice that you're facing as a human being, is directly connected to the injustices that other people are facing, if you haven't really moved as activists in the 60s, like Malcolm X were encouraging us to, from civil rights to human rights, you know, then you're not really understanding how there's this superstructure that you're reinforcing, and therefore it's affecting your own standing. Like, so you think you're harming other people, but you're actually harming yourself, because that's the way injustice works. It's constantly boomeranging.
And so I think a lot of people, young and old out here, would say, well, it's so big. Where do I begin? And I want to take that on two levels. Where do I begin with myself? Where do I begin? And what is your advice when somebody says they're like, well, how do I even look at what I think, what I do, and how to make these changes? And then I think people can get overwhelmed. It's so big.
Read the book. No, I'm serious. Like, Ibram answered this question 3 or 4 times already, right? Like, you could read the book and get the answer. That's a cop-out. Go ahead and answer it for real.
So I think actually where you can begin is where people refuse to begin. And that is clearly defining terms. And we live in a world in which everybody claims they're not racist, but very few people can actually define that term, mm-hmm. or they constantly change it based on whatever they're feeling or thinking or expressing. And so if you're able to clearly define a racist idea, an anti-racist idea, you know, racist and anti-racist policy, racism and anti-racism, which is one of the reasons why this book in particular, like definitions are at its core, then you can, that's a starting point, because then you can start assessing your ideas. You can start assessing, okay, are the policies I support racist or anti-racist? Am I being racist or anti-racist? That's a starting point, definitions. But people refuse to define terms, largely because they know if they define it, they know where they're gonna fall.
Speaking of terms, some of the ones that I found really interesting in the book, the goal is not to be colorblind, it's not assimilation, it's being anti-racist. And in your book, maybe the first time a lot of people really grapple with that, because they think colorblind is the goal, and they definitely think assimilation, we're just all in here together, is the goal. Explain the breakdown and why you want anti-racism, not the other two.
I'm going to tell y'all a story. Because that's what I do. So the other day, I have a six-year-old. I have two kids. My kids are 10 and 6. The 10-year-old is light-skinned, looks just like his daddy. I was mad when he came out, too. How dare you put me... Anyway, the other one is this genuinely... Like, I spit him out. He took my whole face.
He stole it?
He stole my whole face. And he's a slightly darker than I am, right? Dad is light-skinned, like the older one. So my little guy's name's Milo. I named him Milo because Milo means mild and calm, and I think I, like, jinxed myself. Because he asks his dad, he says, "Daddy, why aren't you black?" And his dad was like, it's like, what do you say to that? But his dad's biracial. So he told him, "Well, your baba is a white lady, so my skin's a little lighter than yours." And Milo was like, "Oh," like unsatisfied. So then dad's like, "If I'm not black, then what am I?" And Milo says, "Beige." That means my man knows his colors. We teach our children their colors and then tell them not to see color. That'll make, why are we gaslighting the children? It's important that we don't tell our children not to see color, because you're basically like, just ignore this thing that's right in front of your face. And when they don't see color, they also then cannot address or acknowledge or grapple with inequities that exist because of the different colors. This is why we say no to colorblindness, right? In deciding not to see color, you're also deciding not to see inequity. You had a whole other part of the question that is... Whoop,
assimilation, because I think of when I was growing up, everybody thought that was the goal. That was the popular word, assimilation.
Yeah.
And this book goes at, nope, that's not the word.
Well, in the U.S. context and in many other contexts, it's the assimilation to whiteness, right? So it's historically been Europeans, or in this case, white Americans, who've imagined that their culture, that their way of living is civilized, that they are developed, that they live in developed countries, and that people of color need to assimilate, into white American culture. Indeed, one of the most important books of the 20th century on race and racism was called An American Dilemma by a Swedish economist named Gunnar Myrdal. The Carnegie Foundation decided it wanted to do this major study on quote, American race relations. Imagine that black scholars were too biased to write on race and racism. So apparently they decided to get somebody from another country to come and do this study who was white, because apparently, you know, of course, white people can't be biased. So this book is known by some scholars as one of the Bibles of the civil rights movement. It was an extremely important book. But one of Gunnar Myrdal's arguments was that African-American culture is a pathological development. And he urged African-Americans to assimilate into white American culture and rendered African-Americans assimilating into white American culture as racial progress. That's one of the ways in which we can do away with the race problem. And even so, that was sort of in the 20th century, you had this march of cultural assimilation. And of course, it wasn't just black Americans, it was Asian Americans, it was Latinx Americans, Middle Eastern Americans, you know, everyone who was not white. Even you had, you know, people who were coming from Italy and people who were coming from Russia. I mean, they were also, it was imagined that their cultures were inferior, because of course, it wasn't just white American culture, is Anglo-Saxon white American culture that was deemed the civilized culture. And what's fascinating is assimilationist ideas, they actually go all the way back to the founding of this country. And during the founding era, you had founding fathers who actually weren't pushing what we now understand as cultural assimilation. They were pushing what I call in my work physical assimilation. So they imagined that the way in which black people gained their darker skins is they left the Garden of Eden, which of course they imagined was in Europe, and then they went down into Africa, and the sun blackened their beautiful white skins ugly. And they imagined, as climate theorists, that if those black people in South Carolina would only migrate up to Philadelphia or Boston and go to cooler climates, then their dark skins would become white again. This was the dominant sort of theory among so-called racial scholars during the founding period. People like Benjamin Rush, who was a founding father, one of the principal and first physicians, even the founder of UPenn's medical school made this case, right? Even the Samuel Bowden made this case. And so there's a long history of there's something wrong with black people, whether it's their skin color. It was imagined that our hair was not hair, it was wool, but it can become hair, right, if we again migrate up to Boston. And now people are rendering our cultures, you know, as inferior. And there's this long, as opposed to saying, you know what, we're different, right? Our skin colors are different, our cultures are different, our hair textures are different. Let's not assess another culture or skin color or beauty or way of living from our cultural standard, because whoever sets that standard is going to render themselves superior.
And speaking of standards, you get into Carl Linnaeus and his breakdown of race, and there are kids in the room, but you just start to realize so much of our conception of race and what, it's just bullshit people make up. Why don't you explain to them what he came up with and how it has stuck, just one of the many crazy ideas that has infiltrated the stacking of how people look at race?
I mean, bro, literally, like, look at different... Yo, y'all about to get this Atlanta right now, because I'm mad. He just decided, like, these different regions of the world were attached to different characteristics. He just literally decided it, right? Like, there's...
Like, in his library.
Just like, oh, they're near the Caucasus Mountains, and they're superior. There you go, right? So, and then, you know, we assigned a color. There were red, there was black, there was yellow, and there was white. Like, it's just like, dog, where did you get? Oh, your imagination. And here we are, carrying it forward and forward and forward.
You have a great example as people try to do the work of, if you look at it like a tree that's stuck in the ground and you can never completely chop it down, it's too big. Look at it instead as a boxer who's going from fight to fight, and your job is this fight. Not every fight, you'll get to those other fights, this fight. And you're nodding your head.
Yeah.
And I want you to talk about that, because it gets back to the overwhelming. A lot of it is in how you look at it. And I thought that was a great way of breaking it down, of how to look at it.
Yeah. So look, I look at this the way that I looked at, like, academic standards throughout the pandemic, right? There was all of this raw about academic slide and, like, we're behind. Yo, we're behind based on what? Some standards that someone made up. If these standards are made up, we can make up new standards, guys, right? So when I think about the boxer analogy, the goal is just to knock dude down every fight, right? Just take him out. Yeah, he might get back up again, but it'll be a little weaker. Nose will be on the other side of his face, hopefully. Then we're going to take out an eye, maybe bite off a chunk of an ear.
Dang, okay, I mean.
I know.
Let me see what happens in her fiction.
Only the old people in this room got the bite off a chunk of an ear reference just now. Shout out to Mike Tyson for showing us how to defeat racism. But yeah, no, the goal is not.
Like,
you're
literally
my favorite. Thank you for laughing so hard. You're making me feel amazing right now.
He literally just spit the guy's ear
just,
onto
just
the floor,
chunk
right?
of ears. And I think we all just kind of sat there like, what just happened? We can do that to racism, friends. Because no, truly, if this is a system that is made up, it can be unmade. It's really that simple. I mean, it's not simple to unmake it, but it's not some an immovable mountain or some tree that can't be chopped down. We just gotta keep fighting. And eventually, I mean, look at all y'all up here. Y'all here listening to us. And a lot of y'all are white. We love it. Thank
thank you for coming.
Yeah. And Ibram, a lot of it is also doing the work of poking at things. There's an example in the book where Black people are told all the time that we do poorly on test. And you talk about the fact that as you started to understand a little bit more, what are people learning in all these test preps? They're not learning the knowledge, they're learning how to take the test. So it's not that you're being measured on what you know, you're being measured on do you have access to someone who can teach you. Usually it's not A or E, pick C if you don't know the answer. Mm-hmm. And so it's just having that knowledge at the ready that when you hear John DeUlio say, here come the super predators, but they never arrived. Actually, everything you take in, double checking it rather than just accepting it.
It was so interesting how when I was a junior or senior in college, and I was thinking about going to graduate school, and I decided to spend all my savings on this $1,000 Kaplan GRE prep course. And so I'm thinking in here, I didn't do that well on the SATs, so I'm just gonna cram and get smarter in my mind, right? Because of course I thought that people who do better, right, on tests, on standardized tests, it's because they're smarter. And so I'm thinking, they're going to help me get smarter in 6 weeks. So I'm like, okay, that's why I spent all this money. So I get into the class, and literally class after class has nothing to do with vocabulary, math problems, none of that. It's how to take the test. It's literally strategizing on how to take the test. And so I'm the only Black kid in there, right? And so I'm just sitting here thinking, all these white kids are going to get their score boosted 200 points as advertised and walk away thinking that they're smarter than the kid who got 100 points less than them. They're really going to think that.
And right? Society's going
and,
to say,
and society's going to affirm that. And then society is going to continuously say that the reason why Black, brown, and indigenous kids on average get lower test scores is because they're not as smart, is because they're not as committed to education, is because their parents don't value education. It's because their schools or their teachers are horrible, as opposed to the tests are the problem, because either the problem are the test takers or the problem are the tests. And it just so happened that those very tests were created by eugenicists. And yes. Last I checked, eugenicists were responsible for the Holocaust. Yes. I mean,
look, we in it now. Y'all look.
And then part of it, as you do this and you start to engage with people, when I've done some of these events or talked on some of these topics, the question that often comes back is people are scared. They don't know where to begin, and they don't know how to get people to listen to them. They read the book, and they want to engage. And a couple of things on that, I underlined a good deal of this book. But you said, one of the falsehoods is this idea that there's almost some sort of magic, that you should share your experiences and say what you think and how you feel, but only using rhetoric that won't offend or alienate, as if this is possible. Make your signs and gather your friends and go march or whatnot, but don't be too disruptive. Don't overtake the freeway or do anything illegal. Make your social media posts, but don't say anything that might have people looking at you funny in school. So you're wrapping yourself around the axle, trying to figure out how to do this. So what is your advice for that person, that 16-year-old who wants to stand up in class, or that person who wants to say something at Thanksgiving dinner, and this is exactly what they're thinking through?
I don't even remember writing that.
But it was good.
I'm like, dang.
Good. Yeah. I was, yeah.
All right. The first thing I'm going to say to anybody is make sure you, check yourself. That step one is okay, before I go out here and cuss out Uncle Bobby, let me make sure my head is in the right place.
Why do you call him Uncle Bobby?
I don't know. Why did I call him Uncle Bobby?
It sounds. See, it sounds appropriate.
Uncle Brody.
Oh.
Is that better?
Oh, no, that's, yeah.
Uncle Brody. Oh. Uncle Brody. Uncle Brody has some stuff to say at Thanksgiving dinner, right? Before you go off on Uncle Brody, you got to make sure you got your facts right. The reason this book is written very differently than the adult version, partially because, there was something about orienting Because I know young people who pick this up are going to be looking to take action. But you can't just jump into anti-racism thinking that you're going to go tear down Confederate monuments. Like, you have to actually, like, know what you're talking about. You have to make sure you're not carrying around a bunch of racist ideas in your own mind. And then, only then, can you have something to say to Uncle Bobby. My piece of advice when it comes to interacting with people who are very clearly holding racist ideas is to ask questions. You would be surprised. I actually watched Ibram slice this dude up with some questions earlier. It was the most thrilling thing I'd ever witnessed. So, can I tell the story? Just, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, put you on blast, but, like, it was masterful. So he had a talk at Temple earlier, and, like, I just tagged along to watch the master. Just the most amazing thing I'd seen in a long time. So this man was very eager to be the first person to ask a question, and it was one of those situations where, sir, you are totally trying to derail this entire conversation. He asked something along the lines, I'm not even going to give the time and space to the actual questions. But it was something like, if this is true, then how do you explain this completely factually inaccurate statement, right? And Ibram just hit him with a question that he couldn't answer. There's something very powerful about being like, Uncle Brody, why do you think that? What evidence do you have to support this thing that you're saying? These kinds of things that make the person talking think about what they're saying or reveal that they have not thought about what they're saying, they're really excellent for both disarming and kind of dismantling really crappy ideas.
And I would just add that, and I think this is for young people and you know, and us older people.
We were born in 2000. I don't know what you're talking about.
The 1970s are going to be quiet over here.
Is we can't engage in what I've sort of called elsewhere sort of feelings advocacy, which is to say I am upset about what happened to Tyree Nichols. Mm-hmm. I heard that there's going to be a demonstration downtown. So I went to the demonstration because I wanted to feel better. So I went there, I felt better, and the only thing that changed was my feelings. Like, we can't engage in that type of work, right? We need to be serious about changing the structure that actually led to Tyree's murder. And the second thing, and because you also asked about, like, you know, people being fearful mm-hmm. about doing this. And I actually received probably some of the best wisdom on the concept of fear from, like, a Will Smith movie.
Wait, which one?
I didn't see that coming.
Is this movie called After Earth?
Huh. Anybody heard? Yeah, I'm familiar. Everybody saw After Earth?
So there was this part. So After Earth. Okay, let me get as concise as possible. It's basically about, like, Will and his son in real life, who plays his son in the movie, crash onto this planet. Will is hurt, so basically his son has to go out and save basically the day. And part of him saving the day is he has to defeat this monster that is trying to basically kill everybody. Pretty straight storyline. So at one point, Will had defeated the monster in the past. And his son asked him, like, how did you overcome your fear of the scary monster? And Will says, fear isn't real. Fear is a product of our imagination. Now, danger is real, but fear is a product of our imagination. And I will no longer fear anything that isn't real. Like, I'm not going to make myself fear something. So I'm mentioning that because I do think it's important for us to realize what's dangerous, right? And protect ourselves from that danger. But don't fool, we shouldn't fool ourselves into fearing something. And I think once we lose our fears, and once we recognize our dangers, then we begin to see, you know what, it is dangerous for me and everyone I love to allow police violence to persist. It is dangerous for me and everyone I love to allow racism to persist. People are constantly worried about what could happen to them if they resist. They need to start thinking about what's going to happen to them if they don't resist.
Don't let the fear keep you from dealing with the danger. You brought up Tyree, and I know you've tweeted and done some other things. There's not even really a question. I just kind of want to know what's been in your mind and your heart, because a lot of people looking at that videotape, I was listening to the 18,000th podcast talking on the way here about it, making sense of that video. A guy who's not even a buck 50 with five people on him who you would think see their family in his face. Though, I mean, James Baldwin, any number of people have told us about some of these dynamics. What have you been thinking as this story has been evolving?
I mean, look, this case is a really salient example to me of two very important points that are addressed in How to Be a Young Anti-Racist and in How to Be an Anti-Racist. Racist ideas can be accepted and carried forth by anybody. Mm-hmm. For a long time, I remember like frequently hearing, and this is before, you know, racism was well defined, and now that we have a definition and we can agree on the definition, this idea doesn't make sense anymore, but the idea that like black people can't be racist. Of course black people can be racist. Of course, anybody can be racist. The idea of racism is it's a collection of ideas that perpetuate inequity, to paraphrase the definition. Anybody can subscribe to an idea that perpetuates inequity. The other thing that this whole incident has really driven home for me is the fact that in order to dehumanize another human being, you have to dehumanize yourself. It's literally not possible to do it any other way. I am consistently hearing people talking about how like Tyree Nichols was treated as though he was an animal. He was, by people who were acting like animals. I think that's something that we all really need to kind of like ponder over, right? What does it take to hate another person? What do you have to do to yourself to hate another person? What do you have to shut yourself off from? What natural human emotions do you have to turn down in order to turn up hatred? That's something we really got to think more about, y'all. Like, and then the videos that have impacted me the most are the ones of his parents, and especially his mother. Right? Like, as a mother of two black boys, like, I started writing because I gave birth to a little black boy. When my son was 5 months old, Jordan Davis was killed in Jacksonville, Florida, over loud music. And I looked at my own kid, and I was like, wait a damn minute. My little boy will eventually be tall and brown and 17, and he will very likely be mistaken for a grown man, even though he is absolutely still a child. That reality is what made me want to start writing in the first place. And I think about how, as a mother, like, yeah, I don't have anything else to say.
So let's see, what can I say publicly? I can mention something that I sort of conveyed, I believe, yesterday to just explain it a little bit more. I saw a story, I think it was in the New York Times. There was an analysis that the officers gave Tyree about 71 different commands.
In 13 minutes.
And then of those commands, many of them were impossible to do, like, show me your hands while you have my arms behind my back. Get on the ground when you're already on the ground. or they were contradictory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the more that I thought about, and then because he couldn't follow these impossible commands, right, it escalated the violence. And the more I thought about that, the more I thought that that's actually an allegory for the black experience in this country. Like, we are constantly being commanded to do things that are impossible or even contradictory. I just sort of harkens back to this. There was this writer in the 19th century who wrote about his life, particularly as a free black man, I believe in Rhode Island. And he wrote about how no matter what he did, it was a problem. That when he was told by white society to work hard, to strive, to advance yourself. When he did, he'd face racial violence, right? You know, the majority of people who were lynched during the lynching era, it wasn't because they were sexually assaulting white women. It was, in many cases, it was economic retaliation. Like in the case of Ida B. Wells, her friend was owning a local store that another local white owner thought was taking business away from them, so they lynched him, right? And so you literally had the black people who were excelling based on what society was telling them they should, and then they faced racist violence, right? And so then, those very same black people, they face racist violence, or they have their land stolen from them, or their businesses stolen them from, or their livelihood stolen from them. And then they're driven into poverty. And then they're told, well, you're impoverished because you're black. Right? And so now you should strive again.
And again, again.
And again. And then, so it's, you're constantly being commanded to do things that are either contradictory or impossible. You're asked to be superhuman or subhuman, neither of which is possible. In other words, you need to be exceptional. You can't ever make a mistake. Or, right, you just need to, quote, act like this animal, right? It's either or, right, when we're only human.
In reading the book, I think the thing that blew me away the most, because it was the most personal, I think I've spent years of my life trying to figure out the right fact set. If I could just come up with the right sentence, the right set of facts, all of a sudden this would all change the other person or in the situation. And it was powerful in the book when you said, this is not about ignorance, this is about power. And it's important to understand that. You have no idea how much time I have spent thinking if I could just find the right thing to understand or say. And so if I didn't ask you about anything else tonight, I wanted, because I think a lot of people are in that predicament, that if I just, in that conversation, in that room, in my own mind, could grab hold of the right facts, it would change. No, that's not the point.
We're frequently dealing with people's beliefs. The thing about beliefs is they don't require evidence. They don't require facts. I was, believe it or not, a Bible scholar at one point. Faith is the evidence of things, right? Right, like even like you'd have seen some stuff, right? Like who, she was a Bible scholar, what in the world? But there's a verse that talks about how faith is the evidence of things hoped for, and like it's like you can't see it, right? The whole point in faith is believing in something that you can't see. And that's what belief is. Belief does not require evidence. So if you are a person who believes that black people are inferior, no amount of evidence I give you can convince you otherwise, because that is a decision that you've made a decision to believe a very specific thing. So I say that to say, y'all, there are people you're just not, the point is not convincing other people to believe the way that you believe. My favorite thing, and I actually don't remember if I really got this into the young readers version, but my favorite thing about How to Be an Anti-Racist is the part where you talk about how the beliefs or the opinions change after things change, right? So it's like, with affirmative action, this is a terrible example, but it's one that I'm going to give anyway. The idea is that, oh, well, these people aren't smart enough to go to this place. Sometimes you can't wait to have the permission of people around you or of people in positions of power to change something. You just have to change it. And then after you change it is when the beliefs will shift. And then it's like, oh, I guess black people are smart enough. But it's not because somebody believed, that, not because they changed their mind, that the policy changed. The policy changes first, and then people change their minds. We just have to remember, we're not fighting against other people. Like, this isn't about me trying to convince this person over here that I'm worthy. There's my senior year of high school. So there's a story. I wrote a book called Dear Martin, right? There's a scene in Dear Martin where these kids, the main character who's a black boy, has gotten into his first choice college, early action. There's a white boy in the class who kind of, he's the main antagonist, and he gets deferred. So they wind up having this conversation in the classroom, and the white guy, of course, is like, well, you only got in because you're black. Who, child, if I had a dollar for every time I heard that when I was in high school. So in this scene, they start talking about their standardized testing scores. The white boy got the higher SAT score, but the black boy actually got the higher ACT score. And the white boy just like flat out doesn't believe him. He pretty much calls him a liar in the scene. I pulled that from my life. My senior year of high school, I'm sitting in AP language and composition, the only African-American student in the class. There's a girl in front of me, and we just start talking about test scores. And I got the higher, she got the higher SAT score, like 30 points. But my ACT composite was 2 points higher than hers, and she looked me right in my face and said, there's no way you got a higher score than me. Did I get a higher score than you, Instagram follower? But my point in telling that story is to highlight the fact that it didn't matter that I was in her AP language and composition class and was doing better than her in the class. She had a belief in her mind that I was not intelligent enough to get a higher test score than she did. Trying to convince her that I was smart enough clearly was not going to happen. She believes it now, though.
You know, and to...
You're going to be so sick of me by the end of the week.
You know, and to you know, going the sort of thinking about power versus ignorance, I mean, let's give a contemporary example. There was a particular political party, I won't name names, that recognized that the ideology of their even white constituents was starting to shift away from them. They began to recognize that the demographics of the country was shifting away from them. They began to recognize, particularly after the election of Obama, that they could not win straight up. And so, you know, when people don't believe in democracy and you can't win enough votes, you figure out new ways to suppress the votes of your political opponents. And so then they started passing, or I should say, introducing these new voter suppression bills. But then they needed to justify those bills. And so they created, out of thin air, this idea that there was widespread voter fraud and continued to traffic in that idea. So then scholars started studying, oh, let's see if there's voter fraud. And, you know, I remember this Washington Post headline, literally Google it if you want afterward, that referenced one study that found that people were more like that alien abduction was more likely than voter fraud. And so then they realized, because, you know, scholars were demonstratively debunking this idea of voter fraud, so then they switched to a new theory, which is that, well, there's this perception of voter fraud. So therefore, that's why we need to, quote, secure the election, which is their current theory, right? So the reason why I bring this up is because they knew all along there was no issue. They knew all along that if anybody was fraudulent, it was them and what they were doing. But this wasn't about ignorance. This was, and we tried, people were like, oh, let's show them that voter fraud is not an issue. They knew from the beginning that it wasn't an issue. This was about power. This was about political power. And if I could just give, one other example that really, stuck with me. When I was researching for Stamp from the Beginning, I came across this study that was published in the New England Journal, what's now the New England Journal of Medicine, which is the premier sort of medical journal in the world. It was published, I believe, around 1842. And this study was conducted by a Harvard-trained aspiring psychiatrist named Edward Jarvis. Edward looked at the 1840 census, which is the first census that had the data point of insanity. He began to see that, according to the data points, that there were more black insane people in the North than in the South. In fact, he found that black people were 10 times more likely to be insane in the North than in the South. So he wrote up this essay, presented that data, and then stated, well, it seems as if freedom is driving black people insane. And indeed, slavery is good for black people. So then Edward Jarvis published that paper, and continued, well, first, in 1837, somebody by the name of John C. Calhoun, who was a senator from South Carolina, gave a famous speech on the floor of the U.S. Senate in which he argued slavery was a positive good. He had no evidence, but then 3 years later, 4 years, 5 years later, he now had evidence. So just you understand, he made a case for something, didn't have evidence, but then it came 5 years later, and he was like, you see, this proves that slavery is good for black people. So then Edward Jarvis continued to look at the data, and then he started to find that in some northern towns, there were more black insane people than black residents. You understand that? He began to find that in some northern black towns, there were more black insane people listed than black residents. Now that, you don't have to be a rocket scientist or a mathematician to know that that's not the highest number is residents than everything else, right? So then he wrote a retraction. He retracted his earlier argument and stated that my findings were wrong. Now, do you think that John C. Calhoun and other enslavers were like, well, I guess we can't use this study anymore? No, they used that study to defend slavery as a positive good until slavery died in the 1860s.
We are getting to the point in rounding out the hour, and I looked at some of the questions, and speaking about history, about facts, we were talking about Jalen Hurts, go Eagles, facing off against Patrick Mahomes. And
I'm sorry, as a Giants fan.
I'm like, fix your face.
We're going to have to let you have a moment. We were noting that, it's the first time two black QBs have faced off. And whether it was at the station or the People Post, people went nuts. Why does it have to be about race? And I was like, well, since you asked, let me tell you. And explain the history of the NFL. I was like, we have to do this story. But again, you hear that over and over again. Why does it always have to be about race?
So in other words, when it's two white quarterbacks, it's not about race?
And in fact, it has been for, yes, give him applause for that one. But it's a corollary to we don't want to know to the point that we're going to pass an anti-woke law here in the state of Florida and make it impossible to know. And a couple of these questions get at that. What do I do in an educational context if I'm in a place like Florida or South Carolina or Bucks County here, where they're taking books out the library, making teachers take things out of their classroom, and anything you want to talk about magically is now political?
So this is a hard question, to be completely honest, because frankly, it's I don't know, you know? And I say this as a person, and Ibram understands, like, we're banned all over the damn country. Like, I'm just waiting for somebody to reach out and be like, yeah, I got this book yesterday, and they pulled it out of my classroom today. Like, this book, I absolutely am just waiting for it to show up on Fox News at some point within the next 7 days, right? Like, what I can say is that the core of anti-racism is treating other people like people, right? What you can do in your classroom, even if you cannot utilize these materials necessarily, is make sure your students' voices are being heard. Make sure you're treating them like they're human beings. Make sure you're making space for them to exist as they are, for them to have histories that you may or may not understand. And make sure that you're creating room for them to express themselves. Because yes, okay, you can legislate what teachers can talk about. What you gonna do about the kids? You gonna tell the kids they can't talk? I'm sure they'll try, but whoever succeeded in telling a teenager they couldn't talk.
And I would say that I think it's important, particularly for educators and teachers, to think about and to really remember that in the Jim Crow South, where you had obviously these segregated schools and of course you had black teachers teaching black students, and those black teachers were barred legally from teaching the truth about America's racial history. They were barred legally from teaching about the Reconstruction and the ways in which it was brought down by white supremacists. They were barred from teaching the truth about slavery as a deeply violent, torturous institution that made a tremendous amount of wealth for enslavers. So do you think they didn't teach that? you think that they listened to those laws and scriptures? No, they figured out ways to teach black children the truth. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a new book entitled Fugitive Pedagogy by a Harvard education scholar named Jarvis Givens, in which he writes about this era and the tactics that black teachers used to teach their children, their students, the truth about the United States. And he starts out the book with this example in which a teacher has a book by Carter G. Woodson, who's the father of black history, on her lap, and then another book on top of it. and so she's actually reading from Carter G. Woodson's book, and then a supervisor comes in and she covers that book, right? And so I'm mentioning that because, I mean, you didn't hear Dr. Kendi say break the law, but I'm mentioning that because there's a history, right, of educators and teachers doing what's best for their students while simultaneously figuring out ways to protect themselves. It's possible. And I would encourage you to read Fugitive Pedagogy.
Yo, hardcover books have jackets.
You can switch them around.
Pull that joint off real quick. We're going to show what we said. Pull it off. Pull it, the one that's sitting on the table.
Oh, yeah.
We're reading Gone with the Wind.
Replace it. Switch that joint out. That's all I'm saying.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about. We hope these courses survive, or we'll continue to have questions like, why does it matter that there's two black quarterbacks, or people getting to college going, why didn't anybody tell me? And it's because you live in Florida or Bucks County. So I want to thank both of you for being here. There was so much we could have talked about. Please get a hold of the book, especially I think even if you haven't read the original source work, even for adults, it's a way to work your way through it and start there, and it's going to make you want to go back to the original source work, and certainly for the teenagers and kids out there. But hopefully the main idea that you all have talked about, if we could all just treat everybody like they were human, where would we be? Thank you for coming out tonight.
Thanks, friends.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.